Beneath the headlines, behind the timelines, there is a story no one wants you to find. Welcome to Some Unapproved Thinking, where forgotten truths, buried patterns, and invisible systems rise to the surface. You weren't crazy. You were just early. Let's begin.
You know the story. Helen Keller, the blind and deaf girl from Tuscumbia, Alabama. Anne Sullivan, the teacher who worked miracles. A triumphant narrative of human will that's taught in every American classroom. But what if that story was engineered? What if Anne Sullivan wasn't a teacher at all, but an operative running the most sophisticated media campaign of the early 20th century? What if Helen Keller's entire public existence was constructed brick by brick by forces that wanted to reshape how America saw itself? This is Some Unapproved Thinking.
Thank you to our sponsor, the Dark Horse Entrepreneur Podcast. Unlock your potential with the Dark Horse Entrepreneur AI Escape Plan, the podcast empowering hardworking parents to break free from the 9-to-5 grind through AI-powered side hustles. Check them out at darkhorseentrepreneur.com. Now back to the show.
Most people don't know that Anne Sullivan arrived in the Keller household in March 1887 with almost no teaching credentials. She was 21 years old. She had spent 5 years in an almshouse in Massachusetts. She had no formal training, no methodology, no proven success with deafblind students. And here's the part the official story glosses over. The only prior model she had was Laura Bridgman. Bridgman had been educated at Perkins School for the Blind 50 years earlier, starting in 1837, and Sullivan had learned the manual alphabet from Bridgman herself during her time at Perkins. The method wasn't Sullivan's invention. It was inherited, adapted, and then presented as a miracle. Yet within weeks, according to contemporary accounts, this young woman unlocked language in a child who had been locked in complete silence for 6 years. The water at the well, the breakthrough that made Helen Keller a household name by age 8, that alone should alarm you. That should make you ask, who was Anne Sullivan, really? Here's where it gets interesting. Sullivan's background is murky, deliberately so. Official records show her parents were Irish immigrants. Her father was a laborer. She grew up in poverty, which is the kind of origin story that makes people trust you, you know, the whole self-made narrative. But her connection to institutions of power hasn't been properly excavated. She was placed in the Tewksbury Almshouse at age 14. Tewksbury wasn't just any almshouse. It was a state facility. It was a testing ground. During the exact years Sullivan was institutionalized, Tewksbury was being run by officials who had connections to the emerging field of intelligence gathering and psychological manipulation. The superintendent during Sullivan's time had documented ties to Boston's elite intellectual circles, circles that were deeply invested in controlling public perception of disability, charity, and even American capability. When Sullivan left Tewksbury at age 20, she went directly to the Perkins School for the Blind. Perkins wasn't just a school, it was a recruitment center. It was where young people with institutional experience were identified, vetted, and prepared for specialized work. Sullivan's time there was brief, just 1 year, but she was connected to the school's director, Michael Anagnos. Anagnos, who had married the daughter of the legendary Samuel Gridley Howe, Perkins' founding director, was the man who personally sent Sullivan to the Keller home in 1887. And Anagnos was no ordinary educator. He had a particular obsession, using remarkable individuals as symbols of American progress. He believed in what you might call narrative engineering. He believed that if you could create a compelling enough story about human achievement, you could reshape policy, reshape funding, and reshape how the nation understood itself. The lineage from Howe to Anagnos wasn't just institutional. Nope, it was ideological. And then there's Alexander Graham Bell. Bell was the one who referred the Keller family to Perkins in the first place. Bell, the most famous inventor in America, with documented ties to the State Department and elite scientific circles, had been corresponding with Sullivan about her methods before the Keller story broke nationally. He had a deep personal investment in deaf education. His involvement in connecting the Kellers to this specific institution at this specific moment was not coincidence. It was a network operating as networks do. What if Helen Keller's breakthrough wasn't accidental? What if it was orchestrated? The timeline becomes suspicious when you look at it closely. Sullivan arrives at the Keller house in March. By April, she's already developing her hand-spelling method, the same method she'd inherited from the Laura Bridgman playbook at Perkins. By July, just 4 months in, Helen has made what's described as miraculous progress. She knows 575 words. But here's what no one asks. Why were journalists already at the Keller house documenting this? Why were newspapers already writing about it before anyone could verify these claims? The answer is because someone organized it. Someone prepared the ground. Someone knew this story would be valuable to the right people. The Boston Transcript, the Century Magazine. These weren't random outlets picking up a local story. These were publications with editorial relationships to power. Someone fed this narrative. And note who had already shown the world what a good deafblind story could do. Charles Dickens. His account of Laura Bridgman in American Notes in 1842 had made Bridgman internationally famous, and it was reading Dickens that led Kate Keller to contact Perkins in the first place. The Keller story wasn't just engineered, it was modeled. There was already a proven template. By 1893, when Helen was 13, she was already doing public speaking tours, a deafblind child performing for audiences, reading from prepared texts, being presented as proof of American exceptionalism. This was during a specific political moment, a moment when America was consolidating power, when it was beginning to see itself as a nation of scientific progress and humanitarian achievement. Helen Keller's existence became a propaganda asset. She was evidence that America had solved the problem of human limitation. She proved that with the right system, the right institution, the right teacher, anyone could be fixed, controlled, developed into a productive citizen. Anne Sullivan's role in this makes sense now. She wasn't a miracle worker. Nope, she was a handler. Her job wasn't to liberate Helen Keller's mind. It was to shape it, to channel her intelligence toward predetermined messages, to ensure that whatever Helen said in public aligned with what her benefactors wanted the nation to believe about charity, disability, and government responsibility. And it worked. It worked perfectly. Helen Keller became America's symbol of overcoming limitation, not through authentic self-discovery, but through institutional dependency. She was always, always dependent on Anne Sullivan, even as an adult, even as Helen became a writer and activist, even as she published The Story of My Life in 1903, she was never allowed to exist independently. Sullivan controlled her schedule. Sullivan controlled her communications. Sullivan was present for every interview, every lecture, and every public moment. Here's the mechanism nobody discusses. The more remarkable Helen's achievements seemed, the more she needed Anne Sullivan. The more miraculous the story, the more heroic Sullivan became. And the more heroic Sullivan became, the more the public accepted the underlying logic that certain people need institutional guidance. That some people are incapable of authentic autonomy, that the system that produced Anne Sullivan, that produced Perkins School, that produced these controlled narratives, that system was benevolent and necessary. Do you see how it works? The miracle story justifies the institutions. The institutions justify the surveillance. The surveillance becomes invisible because everyone's too busy being moved by the human triumph. But there's a deeper layer. Helen Keller had intelligence. I mean, real intelligence. She had things to say that went beyond the approved narrative. By the 1910s and 1920s, she was expressing socialist sympathies. She joined the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, in 1912. She was writing for labor publications. She endorsed Eugene V. Debs for president. She was talking about labor rights, about the systemic causes of poverty, about war as a tool of capitalist expansion. She co-founded the ACLU. She was becoming a threat to the very institutions that created her. And what happened? Her media presence was managed away. Her political statements were reframed as the confused opinions of a disabled woman being manipulated by radical associates. Suddenly, the same institutions that had celebrated her as a miracle now used her disability against her. They got to define what she really thought. They got to decide which Helen Keller was real, the inspiring disabled hero or the politically dangerous radical who marched with the IWW and campaigned for Debs. Ann Sullivan died in 1936. By then, Helen Keller's authentic voice had been completely subsumed into the mythology. The question that matters, the one that should keep you awake, is this. Was Helen Keller ever allowed to truly be herself? Or was she constructed, word by hand-spelled word, into a symbol that served power? Think about what we believe about her. Every element of the story, the miraculous breakthrough, the devoted teacher, the triumph of human will, every element serves a purpose. It makes us believe that suffering can be redeemed through institutional systems. It makes us grateful for the structures that contain us. It makes us see our own limitations as things that can be fixed if we just submit to the right guidance, the right experts, and with the right people in control. Ann Sullivan Keller, because that's what Sullivan became, that's how far the fusion went, spent her entire life ensuring that Helen Keller's consciousness never existed outside of a controlled narrative. Even her diary entries, even her private letters were monitored. Even her interior life was architecture. This wasn't love. Nope. This was curation. This was a handler managing an asset. And we've all been taught to see it as the most beautiful story in American educational history. The Helen Keller we know might be the most successful fictional character ever created, and she was real. This has been Some Unapproved Thinking. Tracy, out.
If this story didn't sit right with you, good. You're not here to be comforted. You're here to see what others overlook. Thanks for exploring Some Unapproved Thinking. Learn more at someunapprovedthinking.com. New episodes drop weekly. Subscribe, share, and keep questioning, because the pattern's still playing out, and next time, we're going deeper.